Hello and welcome to the Functional Health Podcast with Ben Atkinson. I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Ashok Gupta. Ashok is the founder of the Gupta Program, which is a powerful limbic retraining and holistic health program for chronic conditions, including chronic fatigue syndrome, ME, fibromyalgia, and many others. We unravel this program, talk about the foundational science behind it, and most importantly, how it can help you. Let's get into it. Ashok, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. Great to be here.
It is a pleasure to have you on, sir. And you are definitely a very interesting person, so it's great to speak to you. When I first came across your site, I'll admit I was very skeptical of what you were recommending, but this kind of stepwise approach to retraining your brain makes a lot of sense and certainly corroborates with my understanding of the literature in this space. And additionally, I saw your pilot study in the Journal of Clinical Medicine and results were quite impressive, right? Which I'd love to get into that a little bit later. But let's set the scene. In your own words, what is brain retraining and what brought you to focus on this to begin with?
Yes, well, this started like many of us start on our own journeys first, and we've had to go through our own challenges and health problems, solve them, and then want to share this information with other people. So my journey started many years ago. I was studying as an undergrad at Cambridge, and I was in my second year. I was doing great, everything was good, but I was burning the candle at both ends. So I was, you know, partying hard but also working hard, pushing my system beyond its limits, essentially. And suddenly I got the virus, and I seemed to get better from the virus, but my body seemed to get worse and worse and worse physically. To the point at which, in my worst days, I had to crawl to the bathroom. I had no energy.
Oh,
I opened up a book. I couldn't even read the words on the page. Massive brain fog. And then I'd go from doctor to doctor, and they'd say, oh, well, we're not sure what you've got. It's called chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME. We don't really know what causes it. We don't have any treatments for it. You may have this for the rest of your life. And suddenly, that's a brick wall in front of you. And that started my lifelong quest to try and understand what causes these types of conditions and how can we treat them better. And so I remember my worst moments thinking, you know, because I'd met so many people with these types of conditions, I made a contract with the universe that if I manage to get myself better, then I will dedicate the rest of my life to helping others with these types of, you know, previously seen as unsolvable conditions. So then I read a lot of brain neurology, a lot of physiology, trying to understand what may be going on. And I then came across some work by Professor Joseph Ledoux on the amygdala part of the brain and brain training, not brain training necessarily, but just the neurology of how we learn new conditioned responses. And then ad hoc experimented with my own brain, managed to get myself quite well, then got 100% better. And then published a medical paper on that, a medical hypothesis, and then opened up a clinic to treat others with that condition. So we started off with ME/CFS, but then we suddenly realized that the hypothesis was relevant to so many different conditions. So then people with pain syndromes, fibromyalgia, chemical sensitivities, mold illness, even Lyme, all these kind of conditions where there's very similar crossovers of symptoms, but not an obvious reason as to why it's in the body. They started coming to us and getting better. And then we started expanding the number of conditions that we treat.
Amazing. The fact that you made a contract with yourself to help everyone else after recovering from this condition is very admirable, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's anything that hopefully many of us would do. You know, if we've managed to find something that helps ourselves, we want to sing it from the rooftops and we want to help others because it is such a challenging condition and millions who suffer. And unfortunately, they don't have many routes or avenues to healing.
It might seem unusual for some people that we actually need something like this. I guess if we're thinking, why aren't our brains able to cope or rewire themselves?
Yes. So this really comes down to the core of our hypothesis, which is, I always like to ask this first question that answers your question, which is, why are we here? Right. Now, big philosophical question, why are we here? Now, I won't spend the next hour talking about the philosophy of that, but let's look at the science of it. We're here because this brain and this nervous system has evolved on this planet from plant life, single cell organisms, invertebrates, vertebrates, reptiles, mammals, human beings. And so this whole nervous system and this immune system and this brain is designed to adapt to our environment. And we've evolved over millions of years to get to the stage that we are now. And this is what, you know, what's really fascinating. We share 50% of our DNA with a banana, right? So we can see that a lot of the previous plants and animals are actually included in human DNA, mm-hmm. which is really fascinating. And so we've evolved to survive and pass on our genes to the next generation. Yeah. So from a, if we're really a reductionist scientific view, is that the system is selfish and it's designed to survive, pass on our genes, and that's its ultimate priority. Now, from that perspective, what that then means is that the brain and the body will always prioritize survival over well-being. So that's our first clue to, I think, about 50% of the diseases that, you know, someone presents to at a doctor, in a doctor's surgery. The body always prioritizes survival. And therefore, the brain is prone to erring on the side of caution and over-defending the system in order to survive. Hence, the core of then autoimmune conditions, inflammatory conditions, conditions triggered by viruses. We can see there's a common core there, which is survival. The body has now gone into survival mode. And so to give you an example of the hypothesis, let's say somebody contracts COVID. So we're treating a lot of people with long COVID right now. Mm-hmm. Somebody contracts COVID. Now, for most people, they get COVID, their immune system kicks in, it fights off the virus or the bacterial infection, in this case a virus, and then the system goes back to balance. But imagine that your system is vulnerable, yeah, and is weak. So then what happens is the virus comes along, the brain fights off the virus by triggering the immune system or the peripheral immune system as well. But then let's say it only just managed to fight off the virus. It then thinks, what happens if the virus comes back? Or what happens if symptoms in our body represent that the virus is still here? Okay, we must continue to trigger the immune system and the nervous system and the defensive systems, even if the virus has gone, right? And that then becomes the continuous inflammatory response and the ongoing symptoms that people experience in these types of conditions. And a way to describe this, Ben, which I think many people find useful. So imagine, are you a fan of Game of Thrones by any chance, Ben?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Is that right. even so, a question? Just an is that
even a question? I know you meet people and they say, I've never watched it.
I know. It's true.
But let's say some people who are listening haven't watched it. So just imagine a fairy tale, let's say. So imagine, Ben, you are King Ben, who's king of the castle, king of the kingdom. And you have your army, which is your nervous system, and you have your navy, which is your immune system. Okay. Now imagine in your kingdom, there's a drought. So the kingdom's weaker than normal. Yeah. Then along comes an invading army over the hill. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, all the resources get channeled to the army and navy to defend against this invader, who's got a dragon as well, right? Just to spice things up. And let's say the army and navy just about managed to fight off this invading army. And it's a success. We fought them off. But now the generals of the army and navy, the immune system and nervous system, come to you, King Ben, and say, King Ben, we need all of the corn, we need all the wheat, we need all the metal, we need all the resources, because we're in a weakened state. And if another army comes over that hill, we are done for. We will lose, mm-hmm. i.e. the body will die. That's how traumatized we are by that war, just like war veterans get traumatized by war. And so all of the resources of the body now get channeled to the army and navy, and they start firing off arrows at the smallest thing. So if a child walks over the hill, they start firing off the arrows. They start firing off the immune system. Right? And the weaker and weaker that the body gets, the weaker and weaker the kingdom gets, the more the resources are channeled to the army and navy, because the whole body is now survival mode. Because so we want to survive, pass on the genes to the next generation. So being well and feeling healthy and, you know, having fun and dancing and singing in the kingdom is not prioritized anymore. It's all about survival. And that's how we can see that these conditions start, is they start off with a very benign invader, but because the body is weak, it then creates this over-inflammatory response. And that, we believe, is the core reason for these chronic illnesses, such as ME, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, long COVID, and also sensitivity reactions. So mold illness, someone's initially exposed to a bit of mold, The system goes into overdrive. And now, if they are exposed to even 5% of the original exposure, the body will go into a hyper-defensive state.
Yeah. You see this regularly, in fact, to the point of, especially with regards to mold illness, with people that maybe soon respond to anything that stimulates the olfactory system too much. So it might be bleach, for example. And then any kind of smell or chemical in the environment has the same reaction. It's quite fascinating.
It is. I mean, for me, this is, you know, this whole way of looking at these inflammatory conditions, these autoimmune conditions, makes sense in terms of how the body works. But it suddenly starts explaining so many different conditions which have been incurable in the past. And the reason they've been incurable is because modern medicine is based on the idea of what can be measured in the physical body. So we can measure hormones, we can measure enzymes, we can measure blood pressure. These are physical things in the physical body. But the brain has been this black box that we haven't been able to really understand or peer into or even influence. And so we've just been treating the downstream symptoms of so many conditions using medication and using pharmaceuticals.
Yes.
Now we're opening up the brain and realizing actually the brain is probably the central cause of these immunoresponses. And in fact, it used to be thought the immune system was very peripheral, but now we know that there are centers in the brain which control the immune system and store the immune system reactions. And if we can influence that in the brain, we can heal so many different modern illnesses. So this is, yeah, for me, it's a really exciting branch of medicine.
I have a number of different questions. You spoke about certain regions of the brain overreacting or maybe being developed more so than others. What did you mean by that? Is that reference to the amygdala being trained, etc.?
Yes. So a lot of research is showing that there are two main brain structures in relation to our fear centers. So one is the amygdala, and the second one closely related to it is the periaqueductal gray, which sits in just kind of behind in the brainstem area. And so those areas are our prime defense responses. And it used to be thought that they were only to do with psychological defense responses. But now we know they're also involved in immunoresponses, pain responses as well. And some people even think the amygdala is the ultimate gateway to pain and whether we react to pain or think it's harmless. A second area of the brain is called the insula, which sits between the cortex and the limbic system. And some people refer to this type of work as limbic system retraining, but actually that's not accurate because the insula, we believe, is the core part that's being retrained, which doesn't sit in the limbic system. And the insula essentially takes in incoming data, processes it in terms of the immune system, the nervous system, and all the bodily functions, and looks to create homeostasis and balance, but then will create and store immune responses ready for the next requirement. And what's really fascinating is recent research over the last 30 years, but especially in the last year, a research team in Israel, they actually, in mice, created inflammatory bowel disease using specific triggers in the gut. And obviously then there was an immune response in the gut. They then measured signaling in the insula. They were then able to re-trigger that electrical signaling in the insula and create inflammatory bowel disease in the guts of these mice. One of the first actual physical experiments in the world showing that once you've had an immune response, it is stored in the insula, ready in anticipation of the next thing that may occur that's similar. Because the brain is so efficient, it wants to make sure that it's stored it. So the master database of what we need to defend against is in the insula, and then it can be re-triggered.
Right.
And that's why we call our treatment amygdala and insula retraining, because we believe that we're going in the brain, calming down these defense centers so they are retrained and no longer create these inflammatory responses. And so that's the hypothesis.
That makes a lot of sense. And when you say it's the hypothesis, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because I guess we don't know mechanistically what exactly is going on at this point.
I think it's about a jigsaw puzzle. So we haven't got all the pieces yet. But it's like you're putting the jigsaw pieces together and you pretty much can figure out the picture of what is probably going on in the picture. We don't know 100%. And certainly this research on the insula about conditioned responses in the brain, that's quite established now in rats, in mice studies, rat studies. Of course, human beings may well be different. But in terms of even studies in human beings, we know that in these conditions, the insula can be running amok. It can be over signaling in the insular part of the brain, over signaling in the amygdala parts of the brain. So definitely we know that something's going on there.
Absolutely. From, how should I structure this question? So from an evolutionary or developmental perspective, why do some people develop these kinds of conditions? You mentioned some of them before, especially CFS. Why do some people develop them and others do not, even though they're exposed to the same virus or stressor?
Yeah, well, it's a really fascinating question, and it's a really controversial area, but hey, let's be controversial. In our study, what we found is that there is some clear evidence that people who get these types of chronic conditions are more likely to have experienced childhood trauma and what they call ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. So it may not be trauma itself, but it might be mild to moderate abuse. It may be bullying, etc. And we think this sets or creates the factory setting of the amygdala.
Right.
So the amygdala being our kind of ultimate fear center, how we react to our environments. And so what they know is in the womb, if a mother is very stressed, that can influence the amygdala setting of the child. The birth experience can influence the factory setting. And the first 5 to 7 years developmentally of a child, that can influence their fear settings in the brain. And once you have that, then for the rest of your life, your brain is going to be more reactive in that way. Now, obviously, it can be retrained, but if you don't do anything to it, that's its default setting. And so in our hypothesis, that then means that as an adult, we are more prone to learning these conditioned responses. Mm-hmm. Now, people might say, hang on, that's one psychological and one's physiological. This is it. The brain does not differentiate between these branches of medicine. So if you go to a hospital, you have a separate psychology department, a separate immunology department, a separate physiology department. The brain doesn't process the world like that. It has a central mechanism, which is the limbic system and the obviously higher level of the cortex. And whether it be an emotional defense mechanism or a physiological defense mechanism or an immunological defense mechanism, it's all combined as one. And that's why every physical illness has an emotional component. Every emotional illness has a physical component. So we know, let's say you have flu, but how do you emotionally feel when you have flu? You feel pretty crap,
yeah,
right?
Awful.
Down and depressed and demotivated, and you don't want to do anything. That's deliberate because your brain wants you to relax and do nothing so that you allow the healing to occur. We now know that 50% of depression cases are probably inflammatory diseases, mm-hmm. which have created this communication between the brain and the gut, which is then causing these vicious cycles and creating ongoing inflammation, which is creating low mood. And so when we realize that, we can recognize that, yes, some people are more prone to this because of their past and how it influences their brain's reactivity to not only emotional circumstances, but physiological circumstances as well.
In using that theory, would it be safe to say, maybe not safe to say, would it make sense that cognitive behavioral therapy, let's say you did have a stressor when you were younger, would maybe result in you being less prone to these kinds of conditions in the future if it's addressed early?
Potentially. I mean, we don't have necessary research on that. And remembering that even if people have gone through a bout of cognitive behavioral therapy, that doesn't necessarily reset their amygdalas. What that does is that enables them to, have more conscious control perhaps over some of these thoughts, the processes that are coming up, and being able to handle them and shift their perspectives on situations. But it doesn't mean that the amygdala itself is necessarily becoming less reactive. So when it comes to then a physiological condition, it may have the same level of reactivity.
Yeah, that's an important distinction.
And we find actually meditation
and
mindfulness.
Sorry, I was just going to say it's an important distinction as well, because even though I think what you do and CBT, they are related but distinct.
Yes. And people, we get this question all the time, is this just CBT? Is this just thinking differently? And what I would say is that what our work is closer to is rehabilitation processes. Mm-hmm. Where let's say somebody has a stroke, right? And they lose the ability to move an arm or a leg. Now, they will go through a process of rehabilitation where the brain has to be trained to relearn those connections and relearn to be able to move parts of the body. Now, that's not CBT. You can't think positive or reframe thoughts in order to be able to learn that. That's a process of repetition and cognitive restructuring and allowing the brain to regain control over an unconscious process. Mm-hmm. So in a similar way, we're different to CBT. And it's like, let's say you have your first driving lesson. So CBT would be, I sit there in my first driving lesson, and if I'm positive and I reframe my thought patterns and I'm able to think in a different way, I'll be able to learn to drive this car. Well, no. Actually, the only way you can learn to drive the car is to move the gear stick, move the steering wheel, press the gas. All of those things combined, eventually you train your brain to do it unconsciously. And then you can be eating a sandwich, listening to music, and those processes have become unconscious and automatic. Now, of course, CBT is also rewiring the brain. But here in neuroplasticity and brain retraining techniques, it's much more about specific repetition of processes to access the unconscious.
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you very much for clarifying that as well. Because originally when I came across your work, I did assume it was part of CBT, right? And then I looked into it further and it was very much distinct. Quick pause. We're thrilled to say that our sponsor for this podcast today is Human People. Human People is a personalized health platform set up by functionally trained doctors and nutritionists right here in the UK. And they're on a mission to give you a healthier, longer and more productive life. When we start to feel a bit tired, get aches, pains, or brain fog, it can be a challenge to work out the root cause of that problem and how we can solve it. Well, Human People are offering a solution. They empower you to better understand your health issues and use AI technology to provide clear, actionable steps to help you meet your goals. Choose between blood, DNA, and gut tests to look for common nutritional deficiencies and important gene SNPs, and get your personalized recommendations reviewed by a doctor, and all for less than a price of your daily coffee. The quality of their supplements is excellent, and their recyclable packs means no more plastic bottles filling up your cupboard. Better for you, better for the planet. Head over to humanpeople.co/functionalhealth and use code functionalhealth, all one word, at checkout to get 10% off any of their tests. And if you purchase any of their bundles, you'll get 6 months of a high-quality omega-3 supplement absolutely free. Feel better, live healthier, and start your journey today at humanpeople.co/functionalhealth. Back to the show. Just to go back to long COVID, and this might be quite controversial, but like you said before, you know, let's be controversial. I should preface this by saying that I know long COVID exists, and I certainly know some people which are severely affected by it. But I fear that there is an element of a nocebo effect which comes into play here. And essentially what I mean by this is that the symptoms may be exacerbated or indeed manifest themselves based on a neurological behavioral response of what they expect to happen due to a hyper awareness of the condition. And this response would be above and beyond the physiological condition itself. Is this something that you've seen or that you know of? I thought you'd be a good person to ask.
Now, this is definitely a controversial area because firstly, what I want to say is these conditions are definitely in the unconscious brain. However, what you're describing there, so these are real physical conditions in the unconscious brain, but what you're describing can exacerbate the situation for sure. So I think it's both and. Mm-hmm. And therefore, even our hypothesis, we believe, is the root cause of the placebo effect and the nocebo effect, right, which is... So let's say in a nocebo effect, let's say we have got symptoms after a virus, mm-hmm, after COVID. Now, of course, if we then become hyper aware of that and we become hyper worried about that, what we're doing is we are training the brain through that repetitive process to be even more hyper vigilant and feel it a lack of safety. And therefore, in that sense of lack of safety, just like the kingdom having a drought and feeling weak, it exacerbates the brain's perception that we are in danger, therefore enhancing the immune response and the nervous system response and making it even stronger. And therefore, we can see how that nocebo effect actually plays out in the brain, mm-hmm, and how it can enhance these things. Same with the placebo effect. We believe the placebo effect is essentially when you believe that you are going to heal from something because you've taken a pill. What you've essentially done is created a sense of safety in your brain. You keep telling your brain, I'm now safe. I'm going to be okay. Therefore, the brain's, it naturally relaxes the stress response and the nervous system response. And if there are any immune responses going on that are inappropriate, it can dial back immune responses And therefore, that is also part of the placebo effect. But it's not. But the placebo effect is, when it's done passively, imagine if you actually recruited this in a neuroplasticity approach at a very deep, powerful level, that's where the self-healing comes in. So it's not even the placebo effect anymore. It's the self-healing effect of being able to train the brain that we are in a sense of safety, and therefore, let's get back to homeostasis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Do you see this being similar among nearly every condition that you've treated?
I mean, there are nuances, for sure. And I think, especially with sensitivity reactions, people can feel that they need to remove themselves from any mold or any of these chemicals before they're going to be able to heal. So that's a slightly different thing. But essentially, yes, the modalities are very similar, which is teaching the brain that an experience that they previously had, which was perceived as dangerous, is no longer dangerous.
Yes.
So updating the brain. And what is the immune response? The immune response is simply a danger response, a defense response to a perceived threat. That threat just happens to be a virus or a bacterial infection versus a tiger running towards us. So we talk about the fight or flight response in terms of emotional reactions. Mm-hmm. The immune response is essentially a danger and defense response related to biological threats. And therefore, our treatment is pretty similar no matter what the condition.
Right, I see. So it seems to very much complement functional medicine and interventional techniques.
Yes, and we're not dogmatic, so we don't say, okay, stop taking supplements, stop taking medications, only do our program. It's definitely a complementary approach. And, you know, the analogy we give is, imagine you're standing on a bridge and you look down in the water, and in the river there are people drowning. So you jump in, you save that person. And then you look down, there's another person in the river. So you jump in and you save that person. And then you open up a clinic and a hospital near that bridge because there's so many people in the water. But nobody's asking the question, who's throwing these people into the water in the first place, upstream?
Yeah.
Like, what is the root cause of this illness? What's the logical reason why there are people in the water? So a lot of the supplementation and the medication can heal people because you're saving enough people out of the water that resets the brain-gut axis and is able to bring someone back to homeostasis. What we're doing is working further upstream in this scenario and going to the ultimate cause. But of course, if a patient chooses to do both at the same time, that can be very beneficial, and therefore it's a both-and approach.
I also feel like there will be circumstances where functional medicine may have to come in, especially if it's a mechanistic issue and there's literally just not enough of a vitamin or a cofactor for an enzymatic process. But equally, a lot of these things, like you've outlined, may start with the brain to begin with, based on the previous experiences in childhood, for example.
Exactly. And if I look at a lot of people that I know, even my own experiences, you know, when we are in good healing environments, our bodies like are pretty good and can handle most things, right? So let's say I had a very stressful day or stressful week at my clinic, and I'm working late and lots of things going on. I really have to watch my diet. I have to make sure I'm drinking lots of water and not having rubbish food and to keep my energy levels up, etc. But I go on holiday for like a couple of weeks. The first couple of days I'll be really tired because my body's just getting used to having rest and catching up on sleep. But then on the holiday, I can have fried foods, I can have sugar, I can eat whatever I want, do whatever I want, hardly sleep, and I'm fine.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where when the body is in this altered state of continual lifestyle stress from lack of sleep, emotional stress, glued to a screen, then we have to really watch out for these downstream effects and have to be really careful with how we treat our bodies. Mm-hmm. When we get our bodies and minds into the right state of being in a relaxed parasympathetic state, then actually our bodies can handle a lot more than they can when they're in a stress state.
Yes, yeah. I would entirely agree with that. I'd like to shift, because I'm conscious of your time, to your results in the journal. So you ran a controlled trial. I'd be interested to know, like, what were your initial thoughts and what you'd find? And also, maybe you could outline your results here for everyone listening.
Sure. So we initially, our first study was a clinical audit, which didn't have a control group. Which we conducted a while back, and that was for ME/CFS, and that found that 2/3 of patients reached 80 to 100% recovery, and 92% of patients improved. Right, so that's a small study, but no control. Then we did this controlled study, which was we believe the first randomized controlled trial ever published on this type of neuroplasticity approach. And it was on fibromyalgia patients. And what it found was that just after an 8-week intervention, now our program is a 6-month program, but an 8-week intervention, compared to a control group, we had a halving of pain, a 40% reduction in fibromyalgia scoring, and a halving of anxiety and depression, and very small scale effects in terms of control groups. So it was a fantastic result. And those patients in the follow-ups also continued to do well compared to the control group, which was great. And so, you know, this shows us that we now want to do more and more research to prove this in larger scale trials. And obviously these things can be hit and miss. It has to be the right type of trial. But these, you know, once we publish more data, then that opens up mainstream medicine to say, okay, there is something in this, because the data is showing trends that this can really heal and help people. And I think the greatest challenge that we have is people actually doing the program.
Right? Because I think with any intervention, right? That's the biggest problem.
It's the biggest problem. It's a challenge.
The challenge, yes.
It's a challenge because with medications, people are very clear, right? Take this medication. And even then, it's hard to get people to stick to it. But imagine a behavioral intervention or a brain retraining intervention where there are exercises they need to do each day for at least half an hour. They need to dedicate some time to this and need to be motivated to do that. And so that's really what we're working on, is how can you make the program easier and easier and easier to use so it can integrate into someone's day and it becomes natural, a part of who they are. And when people do that, and we've done research, we've done surveys on our audience, when people do stick to it and use it at least 6 days a week, those are the people who get the best results. Mm-hmm. And they stick to it for a longer period of time. So we know the results are better. And of course, causality and whatever, but that's really what we want to encourage people to do, is be motivated, stick to the program, and it becomes part of your identity. Yeah, it's a bit like if you go on a meditation program, you might go and meditate like a few times a week for 8 weeks and think, oh, great, I've done that. But that's really not learning meditation. Meditation is about a regularity, at least, 5 or 6 days a week you're meditating, and it's become long-term part of your life and your identity. And that's what's required with brain retraining, is that we get people who brain retrain within weeks and get healed and get better. But then they become complacent when they get back into normal life and the stress triggers calm and then the symptoms are re-triggered. And they have to make these types of processes part of their identity and who they are. Not doing the whole program for the rest of their life, but certain aspects of it to keep on top of the symptoms.
With the program itself, I mean, I find it fascinating. Getting a 50% reduction in pain, I think, is astonishing within an 8-week period. I'd love to see what you can do with longer term trials. How did you develop it? Because I guess, like, broad strokes, I was quite interested to understand how you developed the framework of what this program was going to look like and how you knew hoped it would have efficacy.
Yeah, so I actually worked, obviously, initially on my own brain. So I was like patient one, patient zero, as they say. And then after that, when I opened up my clinic, I spent 7 years working with people one-on-one. And I think that's really the foundational aspect of this, because that enabled me to really see what's working for people, what nuances, what changes. So I was designing and shifting and adapting it according to what patients were giving me as their feedback. Mm-hmm. And that helped me refine it to say, okay, now I'm getting to a stage where it's working for most people most of the time. Okay, we're ready to publish this. And so we were the first neuroplasticity program to publish in 2007. It was a DVD program back in the day of DVDs. And, since then there have been, how can I politely put it, other programs that have come out that have, let's say, taken inspiration from what we've done, and which is fine, but we are constantly trying to update and improve it with the number of patients we're seeing and make it easier and easier to use and hopefully get better results with patients as well. And unfortunately, some of these other programs that have come out, they've lost some of the essence of it, because they've come with a very boot camp approach, which is, do this thing again and again. But the brain, these approaches have to be done in a compassionate way, mm-hmm. a step-by-step way. Because if you have a boot camp approach to the brain, what you're doing is creating more fear, potentially more tension, more anxiety. But actually a compassionate approach, a self-love approach, is much more going to give you longer term beneficial results. So I think the attitude and the way that it's done is so important.
Yes, I would completely agree. And having watched some of your videos, you can definitely feel that. I don't know, I assume that was completely intentional. And this might seem like an unusual question, but the environment of which you film the program is, I mean, it's absolutely stunning. Okay, all the videos, etc. What was the reason behind that?
Yeah, exactly what you're saying. We wanted it to be what we call a transmission. So not only are you working with the intellect in terms of understanding, right? So when like people are listening to this podcast right now, we're mainly listening through our intellect. Mm-hmm. And so we're processing the information, absorbing it, but it's at an intellectual level, the conscious mind. But actually these conditions are in the unconscious mind, right? In the amygdala, the insula, the limbic system. And what appeals to that part of the brain is visualizations, imaginations, feelings. And so when people watch our videos, we wanted there to be an unconscious transmission of, hey, you're in this beautiful environment of the Swiss mountains. You know, when we think of healing, we think, you know, Swiss mountains. And there's greenery, there's lakes, there's waterfalls, there's flowers. All of that combined with, you know, me speaking in a very calming way is half the work. That's half the work. People just feel better watching those videos and recognizing that there is a solution. So that's part of that safety and healing effect in the brain.
I've actually read several papers about this, that even just looking at pictures of nature, it doesn't matter where you are, but even just looking at images of nature improves things like memory retention and focus and also senses of well-being. You don't even have to be exposed to nature itself, although being exposed to nature has a bit much more beneficial effect. But the fact that you can watch these videos and still that get some benefit, I think is a great idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, what we would encourage a lot of our patients to do is to be in nature as much as possible.
Mm. Shinrin yoku, right?
Yes. So being in the forest, you know, healing effects of forests, healing effects of beaches and the sea. It's all been documented. And therefore, even just looking out your window at the garden, yeah, can be beneficial. You know, we're not designed to look at geometric shapes all the time and square, which is what most of us do for most of our day. So yeah, absolutely. Getting into nature is very therapeutic and healing.
And for those people which are maybe, I guess, uncertain about jumping on this journey, because it is quite a time commitment, what would you say to them?
You know, I can totally understand that. And I would say to people, it's first of all, getting out of the old medical model, which is something goes wrong with my body, I go to my doctor for a 7-minute consultation and they give me some pills. That isn't going to work for these types of conditions. So we have to do something differently and prioritize our health. And then secondly, realizing that when people go through our program, they recognize that it's an entire holistic self-healing program that helps us in so many aspects of our lives. And so when people do our program, it's not just about healing from this, but they find that their coping skills and mechanisms for life improve. Their centeredness improves. Their happiness improves. They become more authentic people wanting to live a more authentic life. They start discovering more purpose in life, because that is what the program is doing, is taking you away from the old habits that we had, which were probably triggered by these adverse childhood experiences, and to embrace a new way of being that you choose. Mm-hmm. Who do you choose to be? Do you want to be someone who's working 100-hour weeks and stressed out and trying to achieve all the time and pushing the body to its limits, as an example? Or do you choose to be someone that lives a more authentic life, full of joy and upliftment, doing something that they believe in? And this program enables you to connect deeper with yourself on that journey. And so this minimum half an hour investment each day is so worth it, because it's going to enhance all aspects of your life, your relationships, your overall level of happiness. So it's totally worth that investment. And what could be more important with that than our health? I mean, you don't have your health, everything else in life is harder. Mm-hmm. And so that prioritization of our health and the investment of time in that is something that has to be a cultural shift in society.
I completely agree. And this whole idea, people are always looking into longevity science now, but I think health span is much more important than just staying alive longer, right? Having good quality years, health is wealth, is a phrase that's often gets bandied around these days.
Absolutely. I'm totally on board with you there, that so much focus on longevity, you know, how can we increase our lifespan by 1 or 2 years or 3 years? Actually, it's the quality of your life. And unfortunately, now we're seeing people having more and more chronic illnesses. Now, obviously, we have an aging population, so we're going to see more chronic illnesses, but we're seeing more chronic illnesses related to these inflammatory responses, mm-hmm. which can be caused by our food, our diet, our stress, our pollution, and all of these things. And therefore, absolutely, how the quality of life, I think, is more important.
Yeah, in that we are completely aligned, for sure. I know we're coming up on time, and I have one more question to ask you, but before I ask it, please let the listeners know where they can find you and what exciting projects you have coming up.
So you mentioned, like, people might be a bit apprehensive about starting the program. It might feel like a lot of investment. So what we do is we offer a 28-day free trial, no credit card required. So people can come to our site, sign up, and watch the first three sessions of the Gupta program, have even a meditation they can listen to. So they can really get a sense of, is this right for me? You know, without any kind of commitment. And I really encourage people to do that. And they can go to our website, which is guptaprogram.com. So guptaprogram.com. And there, sign up, get free videos, have a little look around the membership area. And that really gives you a sense of whether this is right for you or not.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And last question, what's the most impactful health change? And I can guess your answer already, so feel free to be imaginative. So what's the most impactful health change that you've made in your life and why?
I think there's two. I'm going to say two. So I'm going to cheat and say two.
That's fine.
I think the first thing is just not buying into this narrative that somehow these conditions are incurable, there's no evidence base, that people don't get better. That's what we often hear in some, you know, some well-meaning support groups or doctors, but actually people do get better and they fall off the radar of people in this industry. People are getting better every day. And so it is possible. So I think the first mindset shift is I can heal from this condition, starting mm-hmm. from that part, that the body doesn't want to be in this state. It's an altered state. And I don't believe in most cases, I don't believe there's any long-term permanent organic damage. This is a functional issue where the function of the system needs to be retrained and reset. And then following on from that, the best thing that we can do is not just rest, because we often prescribe rest, but rest can be physical rest, but your mind can be racing, is to really engage in things that calm down your nervous system. So that's the breathing and meditation as a starting point, or whatever relaxes you, whatever deeply relaxes you can help as a preparation for brain retraining. And so just having that belief, I can heal, and where's my starting point? Let me just calm the brain down. And then, you know, if brain retraining is the right thing for you, then that's something that can come afterwards.
Wonderful. I love those two. Ashok Gupta, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. And I hope that we can do this again soon.
Yes. Thank you so much for bringing me onto your podcast. It's been a lot of fun. So thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Functional Health Podcast. You can find links to everything that we talked about today in the show notes. If you have a second, please consider leaving a 5-star rating on iTunes. It really does make a huge difference and helps get this valuable information out and reach more people. Don't forget to subscribe so you can stay up to date and know whenever I release a new episode. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, or our website, and all questions are welcome. As always, thanks to Joss Aurelia for all the editing, and thank you all for your support.